So I've got this book. It's called Hidden Valley Road. I just finished it the other day. Inside the Mind. It's such a good way to put it. Of an American Family. It's by a guy named Robert Kolker, who was on our show not that long ago. It's the story of Mimi and Don Galvin. He served in World War II, and after the war, they settled into Colorado. They had 10 kids. No, they had 12 kids. 10 boys, and then 2 girls. It was a Catholic, military family, and Mimi, the mother, was really the strict disciplinarian. All of the boys were altar boys. In fact, at one point, each of them took a day of the week to serve Mass. You'd have a Galvin boy Sunday, and then Monday, and then Tuesday. They played hockey. 4 of them were on a state championship hockey team. The father had a promising and successful military career, and in fact, introduced the Falcon as the mascot at the United States Air Force Academy. 6 of the 12 kids were paranoid schizophrenic. In fact, 6 of the 10 boys were paranoid. The first and the second, and then sort of interspersed 4 more. Bob Kolker's on a phone line. Welcome back to WGN Radio, Bob. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be back. I'm so glad you like the book.
I was fascinated by the amount of work it must have taken, because not only do you tell this family story, but then you go deep into the weeds on the history of how we treat mental illness. This just must have been maybe more work than you realized you were going to get into when you started.
I knew there'd be one huge challenge of making sure to tell a story where you could get all the characters straight, given there are 12 kids and 2 parents, and you want to get everybody's point of view. And then there's that second challenge of the science. But, you know, the best way to understand a really complicated subject like the science of schizophrenia is by storytelling. So I was hopeful that I'd be able to tame it and get it clear.
Well, some of the anecdotes, some of the stories, some of the scenes that you paint are just heartbreaking. You open with the oldest son, Don, and the youngest or second youngest daughter, and he is standing there with disheveled, weird clothes. Did he have any clothes on? And the daughter's in the room with him, and she's worried about being in the company of her brother, as she would rightly so for the rest of her life. And that's the opening scene. And it was weird, not only for the family, and obviously it was tragic for the 6 sons, but then it was also, imagine it, how devastating it was for the other 6 kids who weren't paranoid to have to live in and manage a life like that. It was stunning.
Yes, for the well children, they not only are upset by what's happening to the 6 siblings, but they also are worried that they'll be next. They go to bed every night wondering if it's going to happen to them, because there wasn't a lot of real certainty about exactly why this is happening back in the late 60s and early 70s. Half of the psychiatrists were blaming bad mothering, and the other half were, you know, trying to medicate it. The family was checking the drinking water. Nobody knew what was happening, and they were trying to keep it secret from the world because of the stigma. And so you have things like that opening scene where the little girl who's 7, the youngest in the family, is ashamed of her brother and afraid of her brother. But in a twist, the brother doesn't hurt her in that scene at all. In fact, he loves her. And it's her who has to suddenly, you know, deal with what her thoughts and feelings on the whole situation. And the book spends a lot of time talking about how she and the other well siblings really have come around over the years and changed their point of view about what's happening. That maybe what's happening isn't a monster movie. Maybe it's something scientific that we can put into perspective for others.
Yeah, we'll get to that point in a minute. But I'm sure folks, when they find out about this, their first question is, well, why did they have all of those kids then? If the first is paranoid schizophrenic, the second one is paranoid schizophrenic and meets a tragic end, then why did they have the other 10?
Well, in general, schizophrenia, the onset is in one's early 20s. So they had all 12 kids by the time the first one started having serious problems.
Yeah.
Now, today, perhaps it might be a little different because early intervention is really the norm now. And so perhaps if your teenager's behaving strangely, they might flag it as a, you know, prelude to something more serious. But that wasn't the case here. Here it was just boys being boys, behaving strangely. And then it took till Donald, the oldest, was 22 or 23 to really become a serious mental health issue.
They were advised not to have that many kids anyway. And you wonder, why does anybody have 12 kids, Catholic or otherwise? But when she, after 10 or 11, they said, you might not survive another childbirth, but she wanted to have, they wanted to have those kids, didn't they?
Yes. I think one reason was they still hadn't had a girl, but then they went ahead and had a 12th child after having a girl. So they ended up with two girls. I think they liked the distinctiveness of having a large family. Yeah. I think the mother in particular liked creating a new story for herself because she had some unpleasantness in early in her life that she was trying to erase and start fresh. And there was a little bit of issues between the mother and the father, trying to keep the father involved in the family. He was sort of a distant figure in the household. So there are a number of reasons why they had so many kids.
Yeah, the dad was ambitious and maybe had his own emotional issues, but he wasn't around all the time. The mother was. She was, along with the father, but really she was wearing the pants in the family, raising and organizing 12 kids. And not just 12 kids, but 12 sometimes beyond unruly kids, abusive kids. I mean, you know how boys fight? These boys would fight and punch each other and break their eye sockets. It was a hockey fight all of the time with these kids. I wonder if there wasn't paranoid schizophrenia in here, if there wasn't just something else going on. The physical abuse they laid on each other was striking to me, Bob.
I do believe that if this, something like this were happening in 2020, with a middle-class family like the Galvins in our era of helicopter parenting, that things would have been medicalized a little earlier, certainly. Yeah. But this is the 50s and the 60s, and it's a military family living for some of the time, actually, at the Air Force Academy on the ground. And the kids were athletes, and boys were being boys. So there were ways to rationalize it and to turn a blind eye to it. They also idolized that oldest son, Donald. They believed he was, you know, perfect in every way, so they weren't going to listen to criticism of him. And then when things got violent, they thought, well, maybe we should let them stand on their own 2 feet. If we coddle them too much, they will never be able to fend for themselves. This was the philosophy of the time.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe we could take a page from that. Not all of these pages, but sometimes let the kids resolve it themselves. But there's a scene in the book you describe, and it's a little later in their lives where the kids are home for Thanksgiving, and sure enough, a fight breaks out. And you know, a fight breaks out, that's you and I bickering about how mother used to treat us. No, at their house, people punch each other. The Thanksgiving table has been meticulously set. The linens ironed and folded by the daughters, and the silverware laid out. It's all there. And one of the brothers just gets up, picks up, and heaves the table, tossing everything to the ground, throwing it at the other. Do I remember that scene correctly?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. This happened a little later when some of the brothers had already been diagnosed. But, of course, everyone comes together on Thanksgiving to try to make it all seem okay, and you know, putting people close together is a recipe for disaster. What's interesting to me about that is that at this point there's some in-laws around. Some of the kids have married, so that the in-laws are actually encountering this situation for the first time, and they're saying, "This is wrong. Like, you've got to be kidding me." Yeah. Like, whereas everybody else, it's like the air they breathe. They're accustomed to it.
So you have this family. All 12 kids are out. The oldest is 20, and now the family tragically starts to see each of them spin off into their own psychosis. Six of the 12, six of the 10 boys. So what's the genetic link? Is it nature or nurture? That's what you work on in this book. What did you discover after this? I don't know if this is a beach read. It has been for me. I've been carrying this book around for a while, although you could read it in a couple of days. It's a page-turner, Hidden Valley Road, Inside the Mind of an American Family. It was on the New York Times bestseller list. It's not there right now, but how is this not going to be an amazing movie? By the author of Lost Girls, Robert Kolker is on a phone line. Humor me for a second. Bob, has this been optioned? Is it going to be a movie?
There's something in the works, but you never know the timing of these things. I think it would be better as a miniseries, personally, because there's so much plot
Yeah.
So many characters.
Yeah, no kidding. So what do we discover? I mean, you say in the book that originally they said, well, it's probably bad mothering, and then the evolution of mental health treatment devolves into all sorts of pharmacology. The question of, is it nature or nurture, and should we treat them with counseling or drugs? But then you finally get to genetics. Talk a little bit about where we are and where we've come from in treating schizophrenia.
I'm glad to talk about that. I mean, the book's really a family saga first, but then the science does weave its way in there. I mean, progress is really, really in fits and starts with schizophrenia. It's two steps forward and one step back. We know that it runs in families, but for decades we didn't know how. It's certainly not a dominant trait. It's not even a recessive trait. It's not like you need two mentally ill parents to have a mentally ill kid. But it's not parent to child either. And so it became very easy for people to say, well, maybe genes don't have anything to do with it. Maybe it's nurture. Maybe it's bad mothers. Or maybe it's something in the environment or in the air.
Or trauma.
And so or trauma. The confusion just reigned supreme during the time of the Galvins. And the biggest issue really was that the medical profession found it so complicated that they wanted to warehouse the people who had it. And that meant either back in the old days, maybe lobotomies or shock therapy, and then eventually Thorazine and drugs. They found drugs that helped manage the patients better. Didn't cure them, just quieted them down enough to keep them manageable. And that's the way things have stood for decades, while the genetics, as you said, suddenly have become more easy to study. Now that we've sequenced the human genome, we can see that there are not just one or two or three or four genes that might figure in schizophrenia, but more than 100. It's a complicated picture, but we know for sure that it is hereditary. And
wait a minute, say that again. Hold on. We know for sure that it's hereditary. You just said that.
Yes, we do. But the problem with the thing about schizophrenia is that it is a developmental disorder. That means that you can inherit the gene for it, but the gene is just a blueprint. It's not destiny. It's not saying, you know, when you turn 21 and a half, you're suddenly going to have schizophrenia. It merely says that genetically you are vulnerable to developing it. So there could be environmental triggers, and we're back to nature and nurture again. Perhaps drug use, childhood trauma, any number of questions of things that might make a person with a vulnerability to schizophrenia develop that disorder.
And is that the current state? Is that the current state today? Yeah. We believe that you have a genetic predisposition that's come from your parents, maybe one, maybe both, and it's beyond recessive. It might not have been in either parent, or it might have skipped generations, but there you are now with that 1-2 punch. You have this genetic flaw or series of flaws, and yet you still might not develop schizophrenia unless it's triggered by something traumatic in your life. That's the current thinking?
Yes, you don't inherit the disease. You inherit the vulnerability. And so, not knowing whether or not you have the vulnerability, you need to watch carefully, you know, to see what happens in your life and whether you have early signs. Early intervention is now really, really a popular thing. If they can medicate early or use therapy early or find ways to move you out of developing this condition, then your brain can continue to develop in a healthy way, and the worst of it can be avoided. I just was on the phone with one of the leading experts yesterday, and he was saying there's so much hope if someone who is 12 or 13 or 14 and having delusions or hallucinations gets help. So much better than if they're 25 or 26 or 27.
Is that the same way they think about autism?
I don't think so. I think autism, you can pretty much see what's happening when they're 1 or 2 years old, even.
And no, so but my point was that
they try to hit it earlier. That's for sure.
Yeah,
and there's hope there as well.
I guess there is
a parallel. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. That mm-hmm. if you recognize it early and begin to work with that child as early as possible, the adult has a better outcome than if you wait long. So, but there's no smoking gun, huh? There's no single gene or two that we could go in and do some sort of gene surgery and fix, huh?
That's right. I mean, it's tempting. There are less complicated conditions like diabetes where let's say for the sake of argument, there are 12 or 24 genes that are players in diabetes. If you can medicate, if you can come up with a pharmaceutical drug that attacks one of those genes, you could really, really help with diabetes. And that's exactly what's happened. The first big game-changing diabetes drugs only went after one gene. But the problem with a complex disease like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or schizophrenia is that there's so many genes that there is no real player that you can target, at least not yet. I mean, I guess they could keep looking for sure.
It would be nice, though, if we were only gauging for a predisposition, if there'd be a test we could give a man and a woman before they conceive a child and just see if we are going to pass along this tendency to our offspring. There's no such test. Is there any hope for such a test?
The book talks about a screening for sensory processing issues, which are sort of a side issue that is associated with schizophrenia, where they actually, they place electrodes on your head, painlessly, and then headphones, and then you listen to two clicks, and they measure your brain waves. And if your brain reacts exactly the same way to the second click as it does to the first click, then you have some sensory processing issues. Like you aren't a so-called normal brain is accustomed to it after the first one and says, oh, yeah, that's that same click again. Someone perhaps developing schizophrenia might have a difficulty doing that. So they're trying to find things like that that might show a propensity. But again, it's just a propensity. It doesn't mean that it's not destiny.
That test is amazing, by the way. It's so simple. Click, the brainwave jumps. Click again. On a normal person, the brain doesn't jump as much because it goes, oh, yeah, that's that click. But on somebody with paranoid schizophrenia or a tendency for it, the second jump in the brainwave is the same as the first. And you say, oh, well, maybe your brain isn't so good at processing this new information. It gets overloaded. There's a problem with the chemicals around the neurons or the synapses. And You know, when you read your book and your description of these things, you so appreciate the brilliance of and the dedication of the scientists and the doctors mm-hmm. that kind of came up with something like that, you know?
Yeah, and this sensory thing with schizophrenia, people have talked about that for years. Have you seen A Beautiful Mind? I mean, the genius, John Nash, the Nobel laureate, who had delusions that there were CIA agents following him around, it was said that the same thing that allowed him to sense associations where nobody else would, the same thing that made him a mathematical or statistical genius, that was the thing that made him see delusions as well.
The family that you write about, the Gavin family, we're talking with Robert Kolker. His book is Hidden Valley Road, Inside the Mind of an American Family. Eventually, the family comes into contact with one of these researchers, and while they aren't able to help this family in any measurable way, it's gratifying for them to know, okay, Mom didn't do it, and there's something here, and maybe we can help future generations. So they were part of these gene studies. Is that right, Robert?
That's right, it's a very, to me, that's one of the more emotional parts of the story. I mean, this is the way science works. There are sacrifices. The people who have these afflictions, they suffer. But if they're in the best case scenario for someone who's suffering, they can perhaps be helpful to the next round of people. And this family has been helpful. They've helped us get our arms around this illness in a way that we hadn't understood it before.
Not all of them, though. I mean, you describe at least in one instance where researchers call the Gavin family, holy cow, you've got like this Rosetta Stone for paranoid schizophrenia. Six people with a genetic line right there in the same family. And they say, we want to do some follow-up research. And they say, we're not interested. And they hang up the phone.
Right. I mean, you have the next generation of far-flung relatives who don't want the bad news. Like, they don't want to know. They don't want this to be their story.
Well, can you imagine?
They run screaming from it.
Yeah,
And in a way, the miracle of the Galvins is that they stayed a family for so long. I mean, that was my second question. My first question to the family was, how did all this happen in one family? And then the second question was, how did you all stay a family for so many years? You could have split off to become homeless or cast to the winds. The Well children could have moved to L.A. and become lawyers and sent a card every Christmas. Like, why are you still together? And that's a miraculous story as well, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a story of the family, which would have been remarkable without this disease. It's a story of the scientists whose efforts you will cheer. You'll come to hate and then love pharmaceutical companies and the federal government in Hidden Valley Road, inside the mind of an American family. Outstanding work, Robert. Thank you for your time, and keep writing, okay?
Thanks so much. Thanks for talking to me.